Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the December 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Well, these days, there's all kinds of leaking going on. For some across the country and across the globe, and here in Mendocino, the problem is only leaky roofs. For Washington in particular, and in capitals wherever the U.S. maintains an embassy, the concern has been the contents of a quarter of a million of leaked cables that were handed to The Guardian in Britain, Le Monde in France, Der Spiegel in Germany, and El País in Spain, and have been put out on a daily basis on the Internet. The New York Times, which had received previous documents from WikiLeaks, was not included this time, but was able to obtain copies from The Guardian. There is nothing that I can recall, apart from 9/11, that has produced such a wide variety of opinions and allegations that have brushed over the usual divisions of left, right, and center. So from sectors that can be said to be traditional allies, from John Pilger and Dan Ellsberg, for example, on one might call the left, you have had fulsome praise and support for WikiLeaks and its embattled founder, Julian Assange, while others, mostly on the Internet, whose names are less familiar, are convinced that WikiLeaks and Assange are a part of a Mossad plot, while a minority believe it's a CIA operation. On the other side, while Glenn Beck considers Assange to be our hero, our outspoken Vice President Joe Biden has condemned him as a techno-terrorist, and the Justice Department is reportedly figuring a way to get Assange extradited to the United States to try him for espionage. Meanwhile, a young Army intelligence specialist, Bradley Manning, who admits to having downloaded the cables and passed them to WikiLeaks, has been sitting in a 6x12 cell in solitary confinement in a Virginia prison for the past 7 months, where he's facing a 52-year sentence. Manning might not have been caught had he not boasted in an email of what he had done and why to a fellow hacker who promptly turned him in. What prompted the initial accusations that WikiLeaks was a Mossad operation was that the first reports in the newspapers that the leaked cables provided detailed evidence, quote-unquote, that the leaders of the Gulf states, led by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, would be fully behind a U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear facilities as well as the Ahmadinejad regime. These reports allowed Israel's supporters in Congress and the U.S. media disingenuously crow that, see, it's not Israel or the Israel lobby that's really calling for an attack on Iran, it's the heads of the Gulf Arab states, end quote. As the cables continue to be released, Iran is no longer the focus, and other cables that have been devastating for U.S. diplomacy among a wide range of its allies have been appearing in a steady stream. While most seem to have been ignored by the New York Times and the U.S. media, they have not been in the countries affected, and the fallout has yet to be measured. Today, however, when I speak once again with Garth Porter, an expert on Iran, I'm going to concentrate on the potential effects of the leaked cables on the Islamic Republic, as well as the drastic rise in fuel prices and implementation of rationing just announced by President Ahmadinejad. These apparently stem from the new and harsher sanctions that Israel's supporters had passed in Congress, which were signed into law by President Obama and implemented by Stuart Levy, the hardline Israel firster who serves as Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. It has been Levy's job, first under George Bush and now Obama, to determine what companies and organizations will be listed on the Iran blacklist and banned from doing business with any U.S. company or its subsidiaries. If one had any doubt that Levy is doing Israel's work, a WikiLeaks cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Israel in December 2009 noted that, quote, in a visit to Israel on 16-17 November, Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, Stuart A. Levy, reassured Government of Israel officials that no momentum would be lost in U.S. government efforts to combat terrorist financing or to pressure Iran during the transition to a new U.S. administration in January. Quote, in meetings with Foreign Minister Zipi Livni, Mossad Director Meir Dagan, National Security Council Chairman Danny Arditi, and others, Undersecretary Levy emphasized recent U.S. designations against, and he named a variety of companies that he's put on the list, would be maintained. Note that this was just 2 weeks after the presidential election, and Levy was not sure that Obama would keep him in that position. But he clearly thought it of considerable importance to fly over to Israel on the U.S. taxpayer's dime to reassure his other bosses, or his real bosses, that even if he was replaced, the operation he had set in motion in the Treasury targeting Iran would remain. And we now know Obama kept him on. Once again, about 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be talking with Garth Porter about Iran. He'll be opening the lines for your calls during the last 15 minutes of the program. If you remember anything from your high school civics course, you may recall the process for getting a piece of legislation introduced and passed in the House, or the Senate. It's a process that usually takes more than a few days, and if a matter of national policy requires referral to the appropriate committee. But Israel has been feeling heat lately, as one Latin American country after another, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and now Ecuador, have recognized the state of Palestine within the 1967 borders, ceasefire borders, and 26 former heads of state and major officials of EU governments have threatened Israel with sanctions if it continues with its recalcitrance regarding settlements and negotiating for peace, as I reported last week. That made it an emergency for Israel and its agents in the U.S. Congress to take action and do so immediately. Thus, despite the hectic pressure of the lame duck session, with some serious legislation affecting the welfare of the American people to be debated and voted upon, Howard Berman, the outgoing chair of the House Foreign Services Committee, who once admitted in public that he ran for Congress in order to serve Israel, was able to push through a resolution without debate or floor vote last Wednesday evening that called on President Obama to veto any United Nations Security Council resolution recognizing a Palestinian state. The non-binding resolution passed unanimously Wednesday evening calls on the Obama administration to, quote, affirm that the United States would deny recognition to any unilaterally declared Palestinian state and veto any resolution by the United States Security Council to establish or recognize a Palestinian state outside of an agreement negotiated by the two parties, end quote. The resolution paid lip service to, quote, strong support for a negotiated solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict resulting in two states, a democratic Jewish state of Israel and a viable democratic Palestinian state living side by side in peace, security, and mutual recognition, end quote. An outcome that Berman and his fellow Israeli firsters in Congress have done everything they can to stymie. White House officials have criticized the recognition of the state of Palestine by the four South American countries and have been working to stifle the Palestinian effort, rather, to garner international recognition of statehood, but have stopped short of pledging to veto a UN Security Council resolution. The resolution, as would be expected, had the backing of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is not surprising since they no doubt wrote it. Said the AIPAC statement, quote, "We join the House in support of the Obama administration's opposition to unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state and join it in calling on the administration to persuade other nations to oppose such a declaration," end quote. Still on the subject, let's turn to Human Rights Watch. It's an organization whose name you're all familiar with. It started out with Helsinki Watch back in 1989 and was designed to keep an eye on human rights as practiced in the Soviet Union and the Socialist Bloc. Many critics of U.S. foreign policy saw it, and perhaps correctly so, as a CIA front. You hear news of its reports on NPR, and you read them in the U.S. media. When it was announced in September that the much-maligned billionaire George Soros was giving Human Rights Watch $100 million over a 10-year period, it made headlines everywhere. And why not? It's a high-profile organization, except when it comes to criticizing Israel. Then it's met with absolute silence from the U.S. media. Human Rights Watch has just issued a comprehensive 166-page report on the Israel-Palestine conflict entitled, quote, "Separate and Unequal, Israel's Discriminatory Treatment of Palestinians in the Occupied Palestinian Territories." Released Sunday, it's based on case studies comparing Israel's treatment of West Bank settlements and next-door Palestinian communities in the same areas. The report concludes, not surprisingly, that Israel deprives Palestinian residents of the West Bank of basic necessities while Jewish settlements are allowed to flourish. The Human Rights Watch report called on the United States to withhold aid to Israel in an amount equal to what Israel spends on the settlements, or about $1.4 billion. That is a very important point. It also recommended that the U.S. study and withhold tax-exempt status from charitable organizations, so-called charitable organizations, that support, quote, discriminatory and other illegal aspects of the settlements, end quote. There are now literally dozens that do that. HRW also called on the European Union and the United States to clearly label Israeli goods manufactured in the settlements as such and on business to end any operations in the settlements. According to Human Rights Watch Representative Carol Bogert, quote, Palestinians face systematic discrimination merely because of their race, ethnicity, and national origin, depriving them of electricity, water, schools, and access to roads, while nearby Jewish settlers enjoy all these state-provided benefits. End quote. The story was reported in the Jewish press, where a spokesperson for Yesha, the main umbrella settlers group, called the report Goebbels-like propaganda. The heavy smearing was left to Gerald Steinberg, the Canadian-born president of NGO Monitor, a Jerusalem-based organization that specialized in attacking any NGO, including those in Israel, that have the temerity to say anything critical about Israeli policy. In a statement reported by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, Steinberg, apparently without having read it, declared that, quote, this is the latest Human Rights Watch report that strips away the context of Arab terror and substitute inflammatory rhetoric and baseless accusations, falsely turning a political conflict into one of racial hostility by using, quote, separate but unequal language from the American civil rights movement, end quote. That this important report by one of the world's major human rights organizations, who is considered not fit to even be mentioned by any mainstream U.S. media outlet, just confirmed what Alexander Coburn told a Fort Bragg audience several years back, that the Zionist control of the media was, quote, observable. A new WikiLeaks cable release that has been received with considerable interest in occupied Palestine and the Middle East confirmed that the Palestinian Authority and Israel were in cahoots with a plan hatched by the Israel firster and unindicted Iran-Contra co-conspirator Elliot Abrams, then working in the Bush White House, to have Egyptian and Jordanian-trained Fatah forces representing the Palestinian Authority stage a coup against Hamas in Gaza in 2007, which was later exposed in an article in, of all places, Vanity Fair. Israel has acknowledged working with Palestinian Authority security forces loyal to the Western-backed Abbas, but the diplomatic memo leaked by WikiLeaks describes a level of cooperation that will undoubtedly provide fuel for Abbas's many critics. The 2000 cable quoted Yuval Diskin, the head of Israel's Shin Bet Internal Security Service, is saying that the PA security apparatus shares with Israel, quote, almost all the intelligence that it collects, end quote. They understand, go on, that Israel's security is central to their survival in the struggle with Hamas in the West Bank, end quote, the cable said. The cable dated June 13, 2007, was sent from the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv as Hamas's forces were routing Abbas's security forces to take over the Gaza Strip. Diskin is quoted as calling Abbas's forces in Gaza as, quote, desperate, disorganized, and demoralized. They are approaching a zero-sum situation, and yet they ask us, Israel, to attack Hamas. This is a new development. We have never seen this before. They are desperate, Diskin said, and as most Palestinians will undoubtedly say, they are traitors. You may recall that a major part of the bribe that President Obama offered to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if he would just consent to a 90-day extension of the settlement freeze was an additional 20 F-35 Jet fighters, which are expected to cost about $150 million each. That would be on top of the 20 F-35s already promised Israel when the planes roll off the assembly line in 2015. When Netanyahu's cabinet, dominated by ultra-right-wing parties, refused to extend the freeze, Washington withdrew the offer along with other incentives it had put on the table. Now, Defense News and UPI report that despite torpedoing U.S. President Barack Obama's Middle East peace drive, Israel is still trying to sweet-talk Washington into providing the additional 20 of the Lockheed Martin F-35 stealth fighters free of charge. Last October, the Israelis agreed to buy 20 F-35s for $2.75 billion. That's money that we give them, of course. But they have long sought to acquire 75 of the advanced aircraft, enough for three squadrons to maintain Israel's military superiority. Even before the freeze, Israel had been discussing ways of getting an extra 20 stealth fighters, an Israeli official told Defense News. Asked if Israel was expecting to pay for the additional planes, he suggested not. "We're trying to find another arrangement," said the Israeli official. Guess who that might be, folks? Last week, Ron Dermer, a top advisor to Netanyahu, told Israel's public radio the government had not ruled out the possibility that Israel would still receive the extra F-35 planes. Finally, some people are taking action. Buses in downtown Seattle will carry advertisements about Israeli war crimes to mark the second year since the Gaza assault. The Seattle Midwest Awareness Campaign has paid $1,794 to place the advertisements on 12 buses beginning December 27, the day Israel began its three-week onslaught of Gaza, according to Seattle's King 5 News. The ads feature a group of children looking at a demolished building under the heading, "Israeli War Crimes, Your Tax Dollars at Work," which is what they are. As expected, the local Jewish community leaders are trying to block the ads. A poll on the issue taken by King 5 News in Seattle attracted close to 45,000 online votes, with those supporting the placement of the ad winning by a decisive 65% to 35% margin. My guest today is investigative historian and journalist Garth Porter, who specializes in U.S. national security policy. The paperback edition of his latest book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam, was published in 2006. He has been writing regularly on American policy toward Iraq and Iran for Interpress Service, one of the most reliable sources of information and analysis about that corner of the world that entered our lives in such a big way after 9/11. We first spoke with him in October 2009 and again this past June. On each occasion when I opened the phones toward the end of the hour, the lights on the board were lit up with your calls, and you'll have a chance to do that again later in the program. But now, once again, welcome Garth Porter to Takes on the World.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Glad to have you back. WikiLeaks, or more accurately, its founder, Julian Assange, has been much in the news these days. While the information contained in the cables WikiLeaks has released to four major newspapers and was passed to the New York Times by one of them, seems to have either been distorted or ignored when the information they contain is inconvenient. This is something you noticed and wrote about right away. Has anything changed?
Well, you know, I have to say that I have not been able to follow up on, you know, all of the possible stories that could be written about the WikiLeaks cables. You know, the immensity of this task is such that one journalist simply cannot hope to continue to follow what is being continually released by WikiLeaks every day. I mean, you have a continued a range of cables being released, and from time to time, I've checked again to see if new developments have emerged on the stories that I've written about. But I can't even claim to know over the last few days what new cables have been released and what stories may be, waiting to be written, because I've been busy writing other stories. So I want to be very honest and say that it's been impossible for me to continue to monitor that continued range of cables that have been coming out.
Oh, no, I understand that because it's literally impossible, and it's looking, there are a number of needles in a large haystack, and occasionally you find something which seems to be unreported here, but obviously in countries that are affected, it becomes a big story.
Yes, indeed.
There was one story I recall where the president of Yemen said that General Petraeus that we're going to continue to bomb the rebels or Al Qaeda in Yemen, but we'll claim that it's us. And in the cable, he said, if some whiskey gets smuggled, then make sure it's good whiskey. I'm sure that right. didn't go down well in Yemen, but people laugh about it here. Well, I'm particularly interested is with the potential for an attack on Iran, which the pro-Israel lobby has been beating the drums for since the beginning of the Iraq War. How do you think the cable, you wrote about it, some mysterious missiles that Iran was supposed to have in an article in Counterpunch early in December, which seems to be a push to that war, as well as the first leaks that were publicized in the New York Times, in which you had the various Arab leaders claiming that they were fully supportive, just the leader of the Gulf state, fully supportive of a U.S. attack on Iran. How do you interpret all of this?
Right. I mean, this is really the fundamental problem with the whole WikiLeaks phenomenon, that there is a media filter made up of essentially major news outlets, beginning with the New York Times in this country, and then you have abroad, you have the Guardian in London, El País in Spain, Le Monde in France, and Der Spiegel in Germany. And these major newspapers and magazines have essentially been chosen by WikiLeaks as the way of getting the stories out based on the WikiLeaks cables. The problem with that, however, is that these major news outlets are not completely objective, far from it. I mean, they have their own slant on the news. And, you know, I mean, I'm most familiar, of course, with the New York Times because I follow their coverage, particularly of Iran and Afghanistan very closely. And the Times has its own political agenda. And it dealt with, it carried stories on two aspects, two cables from the WikiLeaks cables, bearing on the subject of Iran, that were highly dishonest, were completely essentially misrepresenting the content of the key cables that the stories were supposed to be based on. So, I mean, it's worthwhile just for me to, I think, briefly summarize these two.
Please do.
Excuse me, these two stories that I wrote. The second one with Jim Loeb, the one on the Gulf states' supposed readiness to support an attack on Iran, military attack by the United States or Israel. But let me begin with the one that you alluded to first. That is the story about the mysterious missile, the BM-25, which, according to the New York Times, the United States intelligence concluded the Iranians had purchased a set of 19 of these BM-25 missiles, which are capable of hitting European targets, that the Iranians had purchased these missiles from North Korea a few years ago. And this was the headline of the story, of course, and they were saying that this was the revelation that they got from the WikiLeaks cable. And when I looked at the cable, what I found was that the real news in that cable was exactly the opposite, that in fact the U.S. government had gone to a meeting with Russian specialists on Iranian missile capabilities in November of 2009, and the U.S. had suggested that they believed that Iran had obtained these missiles, these BM-25 missiles, from the North Koreans. And in fact, the U.S. made other arguments suggesting that Iran had the capability or would have the capability in the near future to reach European cities with ballistic missiles. But the Russians who clearly had a great deal of knowledge and had studied the subject of Iranian missile capabilities very closely over the years, poured cold water over the assertion by the United States, or assertions about these missiles, and said, first of all, there's no evidence whatsoever that this missile actually, or this alleged missile, actually exists. They suggested that that this could be a figment of certain people's imaginations rather than a real missile which actually exists in the arsenal of either North Korea or Iran. And they said that the missile has not been tested by North Korea, it has not been tested by Iran, and there's absolutely no reason to believe that that it actually is in their arsenal. And the United States officials in this meeting, as recorded in the diplomatic cable, reporting on the meeting, did not really have evidence to contradict what the Russians were saying. They offered some very weak evidence. I won't go into the detail about it, but the Russians responded in very specific terms, saying, "No, you're wrong about that. We checked out. There was about the suggestion that there was a newsreel or video of a missile in North Korea in a military parade, which appeared to be this mysterious missile." And the Russians said, "No, we looked at the video, and we concluded that it is a different missile entirely. It's not the BM-25. It's not a missile based on Russian." Submarine-launched-based missile, which is now extinct, of course. So the point is that the cable really made exactly the opposite point. It poo-pooed the whole idea of the existence of this missile. And the Times was really quite disingenuous in their coverage about that.
Well, and then you might also, you may have some comments on the positions that were quoted widely of the Arab leaders, King Abdullah calling Ahmadinejad a snake, and Emir of Bahrain comparing him to Hitler. One of my thoughts were, you might get your point, your thoughts on this, is obviously the Saudis in particular are very concerned with the emergence of the Shia in Iraq. And perhaps even more so than Iran getting nuclear weapons. But it seems that they were saying things that the United States diplomats would like to hear. Otherwise, the word that they're opposing U.S. policy might get back to the U.S. Congress, and we might get some resolutions put on the floor by the pro-Israel lobby condemning the Gulf states for this or that. Well, what's your opinion there on those cables and the importance of them?
Yes, I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what I and Jim Loeb discovered when we read a large number of cables which relate to this question of the Saudi Arabian and other Gulf state regimes' attitudes toward what to do about Iran, basically. I mean, these are a range of cables starting from 2007. Maybe 2006, if I remember correctly. 2006 might have been the earliest one, all the way to 2010, and from all of the Gulf states, basically. And what we discovered is that the Times story, which sensationalized, of course, this alleged quote from King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia that the United States should cut off the head of the snake, meaning, basically destroy the regime in Iran, or at least destroy its power to cause trouble, and that the Times article also suggested that all of these Gulf regimes were privately strongly supporting an attack on Iran, whereas publicly they were much more cautious. Well, the real story is that, yes, there was some flirtation with the idea in 2007, 2008, with the idea that the United States might be able to eliminate the Iranian nuclear capability very, very easily, very cleanly, and sort of take care of the problem that they were concerned about in terms of the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapon. But they soon discovered, and certainly by 2008, they had become much more aware of the reality that using military force against Iran was simply not practical. It was not workable. The result of that would not be that the Iranian program would be terminated, but rather that it would be only slowed down, and then they would actually suffer the direct consequences of an attack on Iran, because Iran would then retaliate against U.S. military targets in the Gulf. And virtually all of these Gulf states have, including Saudi Arabia, have U.S. bases in one way or another. They have some form of U.S. military presence in them. And, of course, an Iranian retaliation would directly affect all of the Gulf states. And so the cables that you find released by WikiLeaks make it clear that all of the Gulf states came to be very aware, very keenly aware, that the military solution was not practical, and they were backing away from that. And I think the key thing about Saudi Arabia that the New York Times failed to report was that even though there may have been a statement, and I say may have been because I want to come back to that later, I think it's very much in question whether King Abdullah actually said that. But even if he did say that, and even if there were statements of support in meetings with Petraeus, which I don't think actually happened, in 2008, this was at a time when the Bush administration was really going out soliciting support from the Arab sheikhdoms of the Gulf and throughout the Sunni Arab world for a very hard line against Iran, for the threat of an attack against Iran. And we now know that Vice President Dick Cheney actually was pushing in 2007 for an attack on Iran, and that it was throttled. It was nullified. That threat was nullified by the Pentagon and the U.S. military leadership. They thought that it was crazy, and they told the administration that that was not going to work, and that they would not support it. But in 2008, President Bush and Vice President Cheney were going to the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia, making visits, publicly, taking a hard line rhetorically against Iran, and strongly looking for support for the threat of an attack against Iran. So obviously, Saudi Arabia was not going to be making statements that poo-pooed that idea. They were going to nod, in the direction of the United States and tell them what they wanted to hear. And of course, former Ambassador Chaz Freeman, Ambassador to Saudi Arabia for the United States, told Jim Loeb and myself that the Saudis were clearly telling the Americans at that point what they wanted to hear. This is a basic Saudi Arabian diplomatic tactic to cuddle up to please their protector. The United States was their protection at that point, and that was part of the strategy of the Saudis. So that has to be part of the context in which these cables are interpreted to the public, and the New York Times simply ignored that part of the story.
My guest is Garth Porter. A question: it would I know that the neocons have had their sights on the the U.S. Saudi relationship for a long time, and they haven't been able to break that. But it would seem to me that any war in the Persian Gulf, attack on Iran, would be devastating to all the oil companies that need oil from that region. It's devastating to the economies of certainly Western Europe and Japan that depend on Middle Eastern oil. Where do they come into this?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the oil companies would regard an attack on Iran as absolutely the worst-case scenario. And for the same reason, the Gulf states, the oil sheikhdoms, would also regard an attack on Iran once they sort of settled their minds and focused on this and began to look at the reality. They realized that one of the first things that would happen in any conflict between Iran and either the United States or Israel or both would be that the Iranians would block the Strait of Hormuz, where a very large proportion of the world's oil supplies pass through in order to get to their markets. And so you would have a huge blockage, a huge disruption of the global oil market. Obviously, prices would skyrocket, would go through the roof, and you would have major economic disruptions throughout the industrialized world. And this is not something, believe me, that oil companies or the oil exporters want. I mean, that's the last thing on earth they want. So, in fact, I remember there was specifically one cable, if I remember correctly, from the United Arab Emirates in 2009, pointing to precisely this problem, that any attack on Iran would mean that there was going to be major disruptions of oil markets in the world, and that was a serious problem that needed to be taken into account.
Well, I want to get back to Iran in a moment, but there's one thing I wanted to discuss first quickly. As you're aware, there have been a number of internet bloggers who have insisted from the beginning, based on what they read in New York Times, and not the cables, that WikiLeaks was a Mossad operation, while a few others claimed it for the CIA. As far as I can see, whatever benefits that might accrue to Israel for doing so, and none are obviously immediately evident, would Mossad, if it could take such a risk, and would the CIA engage in an operation that seems to have created a major headache for American diplomacy?
Well, I mean, that's a kind of a theoretical question. I mean, I think the answer generally from my point of view is no. This is not to say that Mossad and the CIA, particularly Mossad, are not engaged in disinformation activities constantly. Mossad most definitely does engage in active disinformation on Iran, particularly on the nuclear program. But the fact is that the WikiLeaks cables are genuine. This idea that it's possible for the CIA or Mossad to somehow manufacture the entire population of WikiLeaks cables, or even some, or to smuggle into the WikiLeaks cables some false cables, some false documents, is simply absurd. I mean, that's not the way it works. I think there's been a great deal of misunderstanding about the technical nature of the WikiLeaks cables and the rest of the WikiLeaks documents. The way this happened is that someone in the U.S. military who had access to this CyperNet, CyperNet, put the entire product of CyperNet on some USB attachment and recorded the entire thing and turned that over to the WikiLeaks folks. It was not a question of picking out a document here and a document there. That's not the way it worked. It was the entire universe of documentation which was passed through that CyperNet, which is, by the way, available to roughly 850,000 people in the U.S. government, which means that there are an awful lot of people who had access to it and who could have recorded it and passed it on to WikiLeaks. But the point that I'm making is that this is not a situation where, you know, you can manufacture a document and somehow put it into the WikiLeaks stream. This was the entire product of all of the cables that the U.S. diplomats were putting out at the level of secrecy called secret and below. It doesn't include top secret. Anything secret and below was included in this. so, you know, what would have to happen is that, you know, a U.S. diplomat would have to write up a false cable, and it would have to be sent in, and that diplomat then would be responsible for having written a false cable, and that wouldn't go over very well. Obviously, everybody who received the 850,000 people who had access to it would know that this cable was false. So that's why I suggest that this whole notion of a CIA or Mossad manufactured product just doesn't make any sense.
Oh, well, I'm glad you said that because I'm in complete agreement. I'm going to open the phones in a moment, but before I do that, I want to get back to Iran. It seems that the sanctions are having an effect on Iran. President Ahmadinejad has removed certain price controls that the Iranians until recently had such cheap fuel that they paid about equivalent 10 U.S. cents per liter for the first 60 liters they bought. And then it would be 40 cents a liter, which is just under 4 liters, is just 3.8 liters is a gallon. And now the prices have gone up. There's been rationing. I just read that the last Italian bank has stopped financing Iranian oil deals, bowing to pressure of the United States. Perhaps you could talk about the sanctions.
Well, yes. First of all, I don't doubt that the sanctions are hurting a lot of Iranians. The question that arises there, of course, is what is the actual impact of that politically, and how does it relate to the whole problem of Iranian policy towards its nuclear program? The fundamental idea that we've been presented by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration is that these sanctions would not hurt the ordinary Iranian. They would be targeted so that they would be hurting those individuals and institutions which are allegedly associated with the Iranian nuclear program and the missile program. The reality, of course, is quite different. I mean, when you target banks who do business with Iran, what you're doing is essentially targeting the ability of Iran to have any economic growth, to create economic development. And that, of course, falls, the burden of that falls on the population itself, not on the individuals related to the missile program or the nuclear program. So at the very center of the whole sanctions policy, the international sanctions policy, there is a lie here, which is that somehow they are, targeting this, focusing these sanctions in a way that distinguish between the population on one hand and the people who are involved in the programs that they are trying to roll back on the other. And the fact, the reality is that the sanctions are hitting primarily the Iranian population. Now, they may hope that this indirectly will impact on Iranian policy, that because the Iranian population will become upset about the economic conditions, about the rising prices of goods and the joblessness and so forth, that they will put pressure on the Iranian government to suspend enrichment and to bow to the demands of the international community, in the United States in particular, with regard to its nuclear program. That is to say, the demand that that Iran stop all enrichment of uranium. The reality here, again, is that this is not the way Iranian society and politics works. Every survey of Iranian opinion that I know of has concluded that the nuclear program of Iran is immensely popular, and that no Iranian government could even survive if it were to take the position that, we were wrong about the nuclear program. We actually agree that we have to suspend enrichment and stop our nuclear program and wait until the international community gives us their seal of approval so that we can continue at some point in the future. That would not be acceptable to the vast majority of the Iranian people, according to opinion surveys. And you know, this is a reality that the United States government and its allies on this issue have completely ignored, pretended that somehow that the Iranian government is operating on its own without regard to the opinions of the Iranian people, whereas, in fact, it's clear that there is a close relationship between the desire of the Iranian people for a peaceful nuclear program and the policy of the Iranian government, which is to say, we will not have nuclear weapons, but we cannot and will not suspend enrichment. We will not give up the right to have nuclear power for peaceful purposes.
Well, it's interesting that two nuclear scientists were recently assassinated in terrorist acts in Iran, events that passed without much critical comment in the United States. It seems that there is, and we also had a computer worm supposedly designed by Israel, which has set back the Iranian nuclear program. Perhaps you comment on that. We'll open the phones. I see the first call, but perhaps you comment on both of those situations.
Well, very quickly on the assassination of one. Well, there's been more than one actually, but there were two incidents very recently where one nuclear scientist was killed in an assassination, and the other one was injured, but survived. The Israelis are clearly behind this. They have made no secret of the fact that they are, in fact, carrying out a program to target the individuals involved in the nuclear program of Iran, and that they are regarded as fair game for assassination. This, of course, is this is terrorism. This is the killing of civilians, even though they are, you know, engaged in a practice in policies that the Israelis and the Americans don't like. Nevertheless, it is certainly not regarded as illegal under international law to do this, and this represents a kind of open flouting of international norms. It again is a reflection of the double standard that appears to exist on matters that relate to Israel and Iran. And we can come back to that later. But to talk about the Stuxnet worm, again, you know, there's enough coverage already of this issue to make it clear that it was indeed a U.S. Israeli program, that the Israelis specialized in the computer virus, and with U.S. cooperation, this was an effort to slow down the Iranian program, and apparently it has had some effect on the Iranian program, although the Iranian officials have been eager to try to deny that. You know, there's some reason to believe that it has been successful in that regard.
We have a caller. Number here, 895-2448. Hello, a patient caller here. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Do you know what the Iranian uranium source is, and if it involves in any way the U.S. Enrichment Corporation, whose mission is to supply enriched uranium to foreign and domestic peoples on behalf of making as much money for the U.S. Treasury as possible? And that's in Public Law 102-486.
Did you hear the question?
I couldn't hear the whole thing. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
The caller wanted to know if you knew the source of Iran's uranium, and is it conceivable that it had come from the United States, which provides uranium to nuclear programs under a particular public law?
Yeah, 102-486, and it's the U.S. Enrichment Corporation, which was actually created.
Well, no, let him. He can't hear that, so I don't want to go to the number.
So the okay. As far as I can recall, Iran has not obtained any uranium directly from the United States. It has gotten some from South Africa. It obtained some yellow cake from China. I believe it may have gotten some from Russia as well. And it's important to understand, of course, that Iran has its own domestic sources of uranium. It has uranium which has not yet been mined except for just a very slight amount. It does have significant uranium resources within Iran, which it intends to exploit through mining. It also has a stake in a uranium mine in South Africa, which is not a well-known fact, but it does have access theoretically through its stake in this uranium mine in South Africa.
We have two more calls here, so let's go to the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have questioned, and maybe Gareth Porter can help with it. Why in the world the U.S. Oil companies, and the API in particular, have seemed to take such a back seat while the U.S. uses their military attempt to make the world safe for oil supplies to America? The oil company has been tremendously successful over a long, long period in working diplomatically. Why has it let the U.S. government get us into these terrible situations and threats in the Gulf of Hormuz and whatnot?
Very, very okay. Good question.
Could you hear that question?
Yes, I did.
Yes,
I heard the
good.
Entire question. And I think it's a very important question, and one that I have thought about a good deal, particularly as, of course, it relates to Iraq. And this is, of course, a very highly politicized issue because of the popular notion that the Iraq War was indeed a war for control of oil, and that therefore the oil companies must have been involved directly or indirectly in the decision to go to war there. To the extent that one can understand the position of the oil companies and the role that the oil companies played in the run-up to the Iraq War, the truth is exactly the opposite. The oil companies, as the caller suggested, really wanted, more than anything else, to make a deal with Saddam Hussein. I mean, that was their fundamental position. They were urging that the Bush administration try to find a way to make a deal with Saddam, whereas the Bush administration, of course, the farthest thing from their thought was to do that. I mean, they were less interested. They were really not interested in the short-run consequences of use of military force on access to oil, and they were prepared to essentially pay a huge premium in terms of loss of oil, of access to oil, in terms of putting it on the world market by going to war in Iraq, just as they did, by the way, in the 1991 war in the Gulf.
Gareth, I have to unfortunately stop you there. I'm an excellent answer, but I want to thank you very much for another great interview. And again, the phones are the boards all lit up. We'll have to do it again.
All right, thanks very much.
Have a great Christmas and a great New Year.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye bye.